But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Welcome again to another Verbal Shenanigans podcast. I think it's episode 18, getting closer to 20. Today I'm joined by two guests. Sitting next to me is Adam Press, who's been on the podcast.
How's it going?
And joined by a good friend of mine from high school and beyond, Mr. Bill Perez. What's going on, buddy?
What's up, bud?
So, basically, the main reason I invited Bill on is, one, because we share kind of a twisted sense of humor, and two, Bill's got some very interesting musician stories, a lot of things in the field of music that I think people would love to hear. But first off, Bill, the first time I met you was we were 14-year-olds glistening in the sun.
Glistening.
In spring of freshman year of high school.
Right.
Rocking some nice track shorts.
Oh, yes.
Very, very short track shorts. And basically the way we kind of...
Those are like girls' underwear now.
Yeah.
Well, we were wearing... That's not... that you can't do that to kids anymore. That's like a... that's not a good thing.
It's an all right thing. But
that's what I'm saying. That's what girls wear as underwear now. What we were wearing as our track pant, our track outfits is what girls wear as their like full time underwear.
Yeah. But basically, our relationship became solidified by us talking about our magnificent dong size.
That's right.
Yeah. So. Basically, we would not really talk about much besides the extreme size of our dongs. Correct?
Yes, I mean it's the first thing that you would notice about either of us when you first meet us.
I mean, with those short shorts, it was almost unfair for us to be in track because we had that third leg.
Yeah, I mean, we were skinny guys, but we needed to wear a large pair of shorts.
Right. We were surrounded by many, many African-American track stars, like guys doing the long jump, like jumping 17, 18 feet. But when it came to the relay race, many times we had to sit out because they said we were...
You and I used to do the long jump, and I feel that we were jumping 17, 18 because that's like a normal running long jump, and those guys were jumping like 21, 22.
Yeah, and they wouldn't even try.
No, they weren't even trying. They looked at us and they were like, "All right, this is like a day off."
Yeah, I remember you put your feet in the sand like when you land, you're like, "Holy shit, that was great." Yeah. And then a guy named Chinadu would leap over your mark in midair, slowly look at where your feet were, point at it, and then land about 7 to 8 feet further.
Yeah, and then he'd go run, anchor relay and beat everyone in that immediately after that event as well. And we would just be walking around eating fucking hot dogs and shit.
Yeah. But either way, but when it came to the relay, we always had to sit out because they wouldn't allow a certain dong size.
I don't know if that was the case, dude.
But anyway, Bill, For as long as I've known you, you have been pretty much one of the most musically talented guys I've ever met. You've been completely into music, whether it's playing piano, which is whether it's playing guitar, bass, whatever it is. So really, that's what I wanted to kind of talk to you about today, because the whole idea of the podcast is generally people's life stories.
Right.
So first off, when did you start playing music?
Well, when I was five.
Five?
Yeah.
What, did you play the recorder?
No. No, you know, my mom got me piano lessons, and I took piano lessons until I was 18, actually. And I took piano lessons from two different teachers. The first teacher I took piano lessons from was great because he... it kind of made me like music. It wasn't like a real, a labor task. And the second one that I worked with for most of the time was a really good teacher named Jim Nuzzo, who's just a great piano player and a really creative dude. And I took piano lessons from him for probably about 8 years. And that's how I got into music. That whole time taking piano lessons was the big thing in the beginning, and then it turned into other things.
Now, when you say your first piano teacher, you said he made you like music.
Yeah, his name was.
What do you mean by that?
His name was John Cobb. He was just like he made it fun. Practicing wasn't like a huge priority. It was actually just more about what was happening during the lessons themselves, as far as just kind of like playing with the piano, and also learning how to read music. He wasn't like a great piano instructor,
right?
But he was able to he knew how to teach little kids how to read music and not make it seem like a bummer.
Were you nude?
What's that?
Were you ever nude? No.
Oh, no. I wasn't nude. Nope, not at all.
You hesitated for a second.
I thought about what that would be like. I had to think about what that would be like for a second. Just make sure. I had to check my head to make sure there wasn't any repressed moments. And guaranteed, never nude.
Good, good, good. All right. So you ever play any instruments, Adam? You ever play any instruments as a kid?
I was actually in the band in 5th, 6th, and 7th grade. I played the trumpet for a couple years.
Skin flute?
No. Was not a fan. Not the woodwinds. No, I played trumpet for a couple years. It was cool. It never really hooked me, I guess. In the long run, I kind of wish I'd stuck with it maybe a little bit longer. Now I'm kind of more into trying to learn drums a little bit. Definitely have a little more percussionist in me, I think, than the horn. But not owning a drum set is a pretty big setback when you're trying to be a drummer.
Yeah, that's generally the hardest thing. Like, no one ever owned a drum set when you were a kid. All right, but so Bill, you grew up basically playing piano. When did the guitar come into play?
Well, we had guitars in the house. When I was a kid, and
your mom was a musician?
No, my dad was, actually.
Oh, okay.
And the thing is, like, I couldn't really play them. They were acoustic guitars, and they were really, really hard to play. And one of them was a 12-string, and I couldn't, fit my tiny little baby hand around it. So I guess when I was like 13 or something like that. I got my mom got me like the cheapest possible electric guitar, and it was awesome.
And do you still have it?
Of course I have it, dude. Please.
What kind was it?
It's a Washburn Lion.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Came with an amp and everything.
That's all you need, though. You need the guitar, the little amp. Like, everyone, yeah. When they're learning complicated things.
$100, $100. You get a guitar, a little amp, and then... if you really like it, you'll then go ahead and spend like 30 times that on just a guitar. That's going to also easily go out of tune, sound like shit.
Easily.
Yeah. But some recording engineers can tell you it sounds like shit.
Always the way to start is like those guitar, those like Dan Electro packages. Like.
Guitar, oh, yeah.
Yeah. like a Guitar Center, the 99.99.
Yeah, you're not going to buy some kid who's going to get bored in 3 seconds. You're not going to go out and buy him a good guitar that costs $2,000. You're going to buy him the worst piece of shit, and then that's how you learn. Like, if you can play on that and you can play well, all right, then maybe you can consider, you know, maybe your parents will buy you a slightly better guitar that's not, you know, basically like a 6 razor blades sitting on a horrible, you know, piece of repurposed wood. That's
a piece of particle board.
Yeah, and then that's how you move on. You move forward.
All right, so, like, when you started picking up guitar, you're talking, what, middle schoolish or?
Yeah, for sure.
Middle schoolish. Now, when I met you, you were already pretty damn good at guitar. You were pretty established at the point, especially since, like, 9th, 10th grade was when, like, I started picking up instruments again, like, other than, like, the trumpet and band, but when I started picking up bass and stuff like that, you had, you were already pretty established. In fact, you were the first, I think you were the first kid I knew that actually had a band, with Durek and all them.
Right.
What was it called? Riot Act?
Yeah.
Was that named after the Pearl Jam CD?
No.
But, was there a point where guitar took over piano, like the love of guitar?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally. For that whole time until I became an adult, the guitar was awesome for probably 12 years for me, at least. It was really, really great, and I met a lot of really cool people from playing in bands and stuff like that. That was really good for me. I really loved playing the guitar, and I actually think that in middle school, that's when everybody kind of discovers music, like picks up a bass or does this and this, that, and the other thing. But I mean, I was kind of interested in a little bit earlier, I guess, and I feel like because I had the background in piano, I was able to kind of figure it out. But I'll tell you what, last statement in this ramble, Mike Durek, because you mentioned Durek a minute ago.
Yep.
That's really who I learned how to play guitar from, because his brother was a great guitar player, and Mike Durek is a really smart guy.
Extremely smart.
And a really, really creative guy. So he can basically play any instrument that he wants. So when we were – he was like a couple years older than me. When we were really young, he was able to play guitar really well. he had this great Squire, this really great Squire when Squires were good. And he was able to play guitar really well. He was able to play like Stevie Ray Vaughan stuff. And kind of show it to me, and then we would jam on like Smoke on the Water or something like that, and I was just trying to keep up with him, but he taught me the pentatonic scale.
Nice.
And that guy really had a really, really, really good idea about playing music at a really early age, and that's sort of like who I learned the guitar from, because we started playing together. He was way better than me for years and years and years.
Right. Now, those of you, most people who are listening to this won't know Mike Durek, but he's another musician, another super talented musician, a man of many different instruments. Nowadays, I guess, he focused mostly on the theremin,
it's
I guess.
Completely electronic. No, he's focused mostly on synths and different arrangements on that, less on the theremin for sure. The theremin is just a thing for him. He's all electronic now. He's all programming. He's all, he's all kind of songwriting in a MIDI
format.
MIDI format, yeah.
Now,
he's just such a brilliant guy.
Yeah, he's awesome.
Really good.
Now, you, so you and Durek start playing together, and you start forming bands. Now, at that point in your life, what are, like, the influences that you're really... every band, you don't say, well, we tried to sound like this, but what were the bands that were, you were kind of echoing at that time?
I mean, at that time, I thought that The Offspring and Sublime and Stevie Ray Vaughan was like me going deep vintage, because I just didn't know shit about music.
Yeah.
But yeah, like at the time, Sublime and Nirvana, Offspring, Red Hot Chili Peppers, those were like, and Tom Petty or something.
Yeah.
It was like the only thing that I really knew, aside from the Beatles, that was like current music. So that's what it would have been. And you know, when I talk to my buddies about that, we all laugh, because when you're a kid, you latch on to like one or two things if you're lucky, and then it's like, you know, that's it.
Yep.
Yeah. Or Dire Straits. That was like the first CD I had. Jeez, Dire Straits. Making movies.
God.
Yep. Great CD though.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, no matter how hard you try to like sound original, you know, your influences are gonna come through. But when you're a kid, like, especially when you're younger, you almost like you try to deny. Oh, it don't sound like that. Like, we're not trying to sound. Yeah. But things come through. I think no matter what.
I mean, we used to just like try to cover songs because we wanted to see if we could play other people's songs. So I mean, we were just like cover band.
Yeah.
We just wanted to play songs that we liked.
All right, so we moved to high school. You're still in the band. Again, this is when we met. So the band I could remember the most was obviously Hybrid, or went through a couple different names. But, I mean, you had songs about squirrels. It's all right. It's time to bring those dark years out. But we loved it, man. Like, you guys had, like, you definitely had a Chili Peppers-esque kind of funk vibe going on.
Right.
So, my question is, like, after high school, I mean, just hearing your own recordings and things like that, I noticed a big...
Horrible.
No, dude, you got to remember, is at the time... You were the guy we would go to record to. So what, you know, like, but you've always been messing around with recording, correct?
Yeah, always screwing around with it, yep.
So let's go through the progression of recording.
Yes.
The first early demos you're making, the first time you decided, I want to put my shit out on what, I don't know, I guess tape was first, right?
We were burning discs. Yeah, we were burning CDs.
So tell me a little bit about like the recording process, like how you would do things. About
it. It's very simple. I'll sum it up in three easy steps. we had a Tascam Mark 20, I think it was a Mark 4. That's a cassette tape recorder that a lot of people have. It's got four tracks and that's it. And that is a great cassette recorder. And what we would do is we would record two tracks to it, and then I would bounce it down to VCR tape.
Really?
And then I would bounce that VCR. Yeah, because it's got a little bit higher fidelity.
Right.
And actually, Mike and I learned that from watching a Frank Zappa DVD. Or not, it was a Frank Zappa VHS at the time, where he was doing that, like, at his house. So we thought we could do that, too. And I actually did sound better. So then we would, you know, we would record a bunch of stuff onto two tracks. Or actually the first would be on four tracks. This is not three easy steps. This is a really long-winded thing. it would be on four tracks. We'd bounce that to two on the VHS, then we'd bounce the VHS back to two tracks, and we'd only be recording on two tracks from that point on. We thought that was cool. And actually that would have sounded way better if our music and the way that we played didn't suck. Like that would have actually been a really cool way to record. And it's actually become really en vogue in the past 5 or 6 years with the lo-fi stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, if our songs weren't awful songs played by 15-year-old boys, our recording actual quality of sound would have been really cool. But we cherish it, and it, you know, obviously we don't like call each other up saying how much it sucked. It was a really nice little experience, but. That's how we recorded when I was like 14 and 15 with Mike, and we used a Boss effects pedal as our reverb, and we would hit the the pedal, like it was a foot switch.
Yeah.
Every time we needed an effect or something like that.
But those are the days. Those are the days you treasure, man. Where it was more like DIY and let's figure it out, and where you have endless hours to fuck around. You know,
yeah, we were in my mom's basement, dude. It was great. I mean, you know, Dan had his drum kit set up. Dan Diana.
Yep.
And you know, it was great, dude. It was a whole bunch of fun. I mean, you know, it didn't matter that, you know, we weren't really, you know, killing it musically. You know, nobody's doing that at that age. But the recording thing was really, really fun, and we had no idea what we were doing. And we would even master it through Mike's dad's, like, record hi-fi system, because it had an equalizer on it. So we would, like, pass it through that.
Interesting.
And then record it onto a disc, because we thought that that was, like, we knew that it was, like, an expensive high-end piece of audio equipment, so we thought if we would just pass it through that and burn it onto a disc that way, it would sound better.
Like you magically put it through there and it just enhances everything?
Well, yeah, a lot of people think that still. Not, like, expensive recording equipment. So we did that, and then, you know, it had a sound, man. Had a sound.
No, but, like, those are the – I mean, you know – even in the days where I was like I mentioned this on the two podcasts ago when I had Teddy on, you know, just the days of having the amount of time to try to record on your own and learn, like, to how to fuck up is like the best way to learn. Like,
yeah, tell me about it, dude. Like, that's like
holy shit, life. This is what the gain switch does. Like, yeah. I guess that was too high. This is what panning means. Oh, shit, we record, you know, like.
That's the only true way to learn about any of that stuff, is to, you know, have the time to make mistakes, you know.
And then.
Eyes.
Go ahead. In many facets of life, it's almost easier to learn from what not to do. And then as long as you hold on to that and get a lesson out of everything, you're learning what not to do is just as valuable as learning the right way to do it, and sometimes more so.
That's absolutely correct.
So, all right. So you come out of high school. Now, at that point, was the band still together or no? I can't remember.
No, not really. No.
No, kind of fading away.
Yeah, I mean, we all
like all bands do
things. Actually, I moved in with Mike Doric. We lived together for a while, like for years.
Right.
Yeah, we all did our own thing. I mean, I started a. I actually started a band with Leon in college. That was fun. And then I played a couple other things that were a little bit more legitimate but not as good. But like with Leon and our drummer at the time, I mean, we didn't have really good songs or anything like that, but we could really jam together. We really loved it. We all shared a house for a while, and it was really awesome.
Yeah. Was that the house in New Brunswick?
Well, we had a few houses in New Brunswick. I had one with Mike early on, and then we had another one off Easton Avenue together for a year, and then we had another one together in Somerset, which is not New Brunswick, but it was a little further.
I think the one off Easton was where you recorded my band with JT and Andrew.
Well, we recorded that in Watchung.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if you went to New Brunswick for that. Maybe you did.
I don't know. I remember the house with like it had like a backyard that was kind of on two streets, like it was on a corner.
Hmm. Wait. Didn't we do also some stuff?
We did some things where we played with the Space Echo for like a long time in your room and in the closet.
Yes, that was in Somerset. Yeah, that was in Somerset. Oh, yeah. I remember. I forgot about that. Yeah, we played with the Space Echo. Yep.
And then you recorded.
Yeah, you were in the weirdo closet doing vocals. Yes, I remember now. Yeah. Well,
dude, trust me, I'm in the weirdo closet all the time.
Still to this day. No, that was my room, and you know, like I tried to make that into a little studio, and I recorded some weird stuff there. I recorded some weird like tape looping stuff there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. Now I remember you guys. And we recorded the drums in the basement, right?
Yeah. That was with JT, and then I came to you to record with another band later on, and I think you had a flood, right?
I think we did another thing in Watchung.
We did something at your studio space once.
Yeah, we were in Watchung. That was over there by the
what is the other street? By Westfield. That was by Westfield. Yeah.
Right.
In that weird, industrial complex thing.
So, Bill, you went to college. What did you go to school for?
I went to school for English.
Went to school for English. Now, I know deep down you're never going to give up the music thing, but you didn't want to go to school at the time for music?
I mean, I didn't know what I wanted to go to school for. I didn't even know if I wanted to go to school.
Right. So
I just, I actually started going to school for music and I didn't like it. And,
really?
So I was able to get my minor. I got out of the music program at Rutgers and I was able to leave it with like a completed minor. And, then I jumped over to English and I finished with English. So I've always liked English, but, that's what I did. I didn't think it was for me.
And where'd you go?
I went to Rutgers.
Now, during that time, you were gigging with quite a few bands at the time.
Yeah.
But was this the time when you started I can't remember. Was this the Walking with Cavemen days, or was that with after college?
That started during then, but it was really an after college thing. It didn't really take shape. My buddy Trevor, I met him down there in New Brunswick, and we used to just hang out and kind of like write songs together. But we never really committed to having any type of band for a while. Actually, it took both of us and our other buddy Dan a lot to like say that we should like have a band.
Yeah.
None of us really wanted to do it, I think. But, that's where I'm, but that was an after college thing. I mean, all that college stuff started petering out when I knew that I really had to graduate.
Right.
That's when I tried hard and did my thing. But I lived down there for a couple of years after that. And, I started getting back into music, and that was a lot of fun.
Now, I wanted to bring this up to the Walking with Cavemen days. I think we actually, I don't remember if we played a show with you or we came and saw a show. I don't remember. But I know we saw you at that bookshop in Metuchen.
Oh, yeah, where we had no PA.
Yes.
Yeah. The PA broke.
But I've always, we always kept in touch, we're not all the time, but I usually know what you're doing, and I listen to your stuff. And the Walking with Cavemen stuff was very cool. And at the time, you were playing bass, right?
Yeah.
Now what made that happen, first off?
Well, Trevor and I, we played the guitar stuff when we recorded together.
Right.
And we did a lot of, singing together and stuff like that. But, when... We never really intended to play live in anything, but we thought that it would be fun. So that's sort of why I was playing bass, because we needed a bass player for if we were going to play out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Now. So,
yeah, that's why I play bass.
Now, what? you are like I said, you are one of the best guitar players I met. So. Was it nice to tone down in a way and just fucking play the low end?
Yeah, dude.
And
love playing bass.
Bass is the best, man. The best.
Best. And what really got me into it was when I finally got my own bass.
Yeah.
I was borrowing basses from people for a long time.
Right.
And I really looked and I how I am with guitars and stuff like that. I really appreciate a nice guitar.
Right.
And, I wanted to find myself a nice bass, but at the time I couldn't really afford to spend, $2,000 on a nice bass.
No, yeah.
But what worked in my favor was that I actually got really attracted to Mustangs and short scale guitars at the time. And I got a little bass. I got a little 1971 Music Master, which is predates
awesome.
The Mustang.
Yep.
And I loved playing it, and I got it for really cheap. And I actually was the first and only guitar I ever bought on eBay. And I was just like, whatever, I'm just going to buy this thing. Hopefully it won't be destroyed when I get it. And it was great. I've never had it set up ever. And I've only changed the strings once. And I've had it for like, I don't know, six or seven years.
It's funny you say that because I think that's why I'm like in love with bass. I love the longevity of it. I love the I love the sometimes not flash of it, the playing underneath, but you realize how essential it is when you're playing it, kind of like you know what I mean, like and there's just like when you play a good bass and you're like in the pocket, there's like no better feeling than that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, when you start playing bass, like I thought originally that I could play bass, you know, because I can play guitar, but I really quickly learned that that's not the case. You have to lock in with that drummer on a really fundamental level, you know.
It's like a different kind of ear almost.
Yeah, it's you're listening for a completely different thing than you normally do. And I think it really makes you grow as a musician to you know, take on an instrument like that and understand it. I don't know, it just helped me in you know, as a musician, just to spend a few years playing bass, just knowing what that's like and trying to do it well, you know.
Yeah, I think that's what's really insulting to bass players, like, is you know, when a band needs a bassist, the first thing they do is try to find like a guitar player a lot of times who will submit to playing bass. But it really shouldn't be like that. Like a bass player who loves playing bass and appreciates bass and you know, lives every moment being a bassist is always a better bassist than a guitar player converted bassist most of the time.
Of course.
And I thought it was really cool at a time when you were, you know, I know you as the piano and, you know, the guitar and, you know, pretty much able to do a ton of things on guitar. So to see you play bass was almost like a shock for a little while.
Yeah, I mean, I love playing bass, man. At the time that I was doing that, I was also playing guitar in a band that I was able to kind of take the kind of back seat on.
Right.
Which was really good for me. That band was called Mirrors and Wires, and it was it was like a punky surf band, and the band was really exposed me to some cool stuff. You know, I got to really experience what the New Brunswick punk rock scene was like at the time, and I got to tour with them and see what it was like, you know, elsewhere, because that was the circle that those people traveled in. So at that time I was playing guitar exclusively without singing, which was a big thing for me because I hate my singing voice, but playing with those guys was really cool, because then going and playing bass with my friends was a totally different experience, you know what I mean? It was that's what I was doing like right around those couple of years. It was really fun.
Yeah. So I mean, I can't bring up your Walking with Caveman band without talking about Trevor. Unfortunately, you lost him.
Yeah.
And I know he was you were extremely close to him, and I thought the kid was phenomenal. To me, he had that Thom Yorke kind of that range of Thom Yorke. I could tell he had some influence by him. But I don't know if you could talk a little about him too.
Yeah, I mean, Trevor was a really, really great musician, and you know, at the time, like I definitely met like a bunch of guys that I thought were really good, but I definitely kid you not, like Trevor had what I've now, you know, in my experiences presently have seen as like what most people would call like a triple threat. Like he was a really, really introspective, like really, really sensitive songwriter, but he could also write, you know, he could just write anything. He was a good guitar player. He wasn't a great guitar player, but he played well and, you know, just played good, played in tune, had good tone. And he was just a really good performer. He could sing really, really well, and he could always do it.
I would definitely tell you, he was a great singer.
he never sang badly. Even, you know, if he wasn't feeling well, and he always sang really well. So yeah, that's Trevor, man. That's he's just a, you know, he was really just a really sweet guy, just a great guy. But you know, shit happens, and you know, it was definitely a loss, because he was just so creative. He was doing way more stuff than he was doing when he was playing with me too. He was always working on something. He was really into electronic music as well, and he's just a very creative guy.
Yeah, definitely. So we go from after Walking with Cavemen, was there what kind of bands were you doing, or was there ever a point where you almost wanted to stop being in bands and just do your own thing? Did you ever become sick of it in a way? Almost get pissed off at yourself or writing blocks or
yeah, I mean, yeah, we can blow right through this segment by saying like totally, like, yeah, it comes to a point where you start doing other stuff where, you know, you just can't you can't be going to band practices and doing stuff like that unless you really believe in it. So it simply got to that point, and I love playing music, but you know, being in a band where you're trying to be good is a huge commitment, and you know, eventually everybody gets to that point unless they've already made it where it's like, well, you know, what else can I do? You know what I mean? Like I for me, it was to focus on a job that I felt very strongly about, and actually have had way more stronger feelings than being in bands and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like,
Bill, you led me right to the point on the meat of this interview, which is kind of what I really wanted to get you on the podcast for. So you, basically, obviously, you'll always be a musician, but you've really, from what I've known over the last few years, focused on recording and engineering and everything that goes along with that. Can you tell us how like that came about and how you got into that and where you are today? And then we're going to talk about some interesting things you've done. So yeah, Bill, you basically built your way up, and you recorded interesting things. Like I said, one day on Facebook, you put on there that you recorded the Rolling Stones.
Right.
And I could not have an interview with you without talking about that.
Right.
So, tell us a little bit about it, my friend.
I'll tell you how it happened. And what I'll tell you is, you know, from my perspective, most recording engineers in my sort of like echelon of that I'm in would not have gotten the opportunity to do that.
Why?
Because you wouldn't get that close unless you were like sort of like one of like the legendary guys or like somebody who's known them for years. You just wouldn't be able to get that close.
Why were they in your studio?
They were in our studio because we host a lot of rehearsals. Our live room is very big, and we rent it out to bands like that to rehearse, and we do it very often, and we, you know, I feel that we do it well because it's extremely easy. We just rent the space, that's right. It. Sometimes we rent audio, sometimes we do this and that, and we always provide like our services during the process, but it's not hard.
Okay.
So we kind of attract that sort of thing. So basically, we have a production manager that we work with a lot, that works with a lot of those types of acts, and they thought that they would be kind of like the most secure, the most anonymous if they came to our studio, and that was true.
Right.
And that was the kicker of the whole thing. No one knew that they were there, and the important part of that thing, those sessions, was that it was the first time that they played together in a little over 5 years, and they were trying to figure out if they wanted to do the 50th anniversary tour and record.
Okay.
So they decided that they would book a week in a recording studio to play and get together and hang out. And I kid you not, they had like very little crew around. There was like nobody there, like no, there wasn't like a lot of people there. It was just them and a couple other guys. And they were really just trying to play and figure out if they could, you know, do a tour and things like that. And it was great. And we actually built like a custom stage in our live room for them, because we were worried that they would have to walk down the stairs to get into it, because it's like a pit, you know what I mean? Our live room goes down when you walk into it. And it was really great, man. It was a lot of fun. And the way that I got involved with it was I was assisting an engineer named David Hewitt,
right,
who's a brilliant engineer, and he's like a really good friend of mine. He's just an awesome dude. And he was on the gig as the first engineer, and then he and I set up for the recording like for a few days before they came in. And then he recorded with me on the first day, and then he wasn't able to do it anymore. It was going to go to Pro Tools, if you know what that is. It was going to go into a digital multi-track environment, and I had to do that. And
now were they there recording over recording just to
hear it back? Just recording everything. They were recording everything that they did. Okay. They were recording everything that they did from the first step on that, you know, in that room till they were all gone. But we also recorded, they brought in a video crew, a pretty substantial one, and at that, and we did multi-tracking for a live videos that they made while they were there, for the time that they were there, which was really cool. I mean, they had like some big roving boom, you know, cameras and stuff, and I had to multi-track that so I could give it to the video people afterwards, which was cool. But yeah, that's what it came down to. So Dave wasn't able to do it after the first day, which was kind of crazy, but then I ended up just doing it by myself for the entire time, which was totally just it's a the once in a lifetime experience. It's just very, very, now, very strange.
No, here's my thing. Like, you literally sat down, like, you mic'd Keith Richards' guitar.
Yes. And mic'd I wasn't doing it by myself. They have their sound man's name is Dave Natal, and he's one of the best live sound guys in the entire music industry. He's amazing.
Right.
He was doing their monitors. He had the wedges. You know, he was doing whatever speakers were in the room. And what I was doing was he was feeding me that mix, and then I was mixing it in another room and recording it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
But that other room is our control room, which is attached to our live room. It's not as if we weren't all right there in the same spot. But it wasn't like it was just me by myself with them, and that was it. I mean, we had some stuff going on. But as far as the recording aspect of it, that's what I was taking. And they did come into the control room, and they did they wanted everything recorded, and it was.
Did you feel overwhelmed at all?
The only time I felt overwhelmed was when we went into what I would call like overtime in a Pro Tools session. Like if they were doing take after take of one song, where we were going into like 20 or 30 minutes into the session, that's when I felt like it was possible that my computer would, you know, maybe hiccup or I would get like an error that I was writing too much or something like that.
Like as a guitar guy, and everyone appreciates a lot of like old Stones hits and stuff like that. Did you feel like holy shit? Like no, at all?
I'm like the biggest Stones fan, and I met the two guys that actually I had really good FaceTime with was Keith Richards and Charlie Watts.
Wow.
And the keyboard player, Chuck Lavelle. But wow. It's, you know, it's, and their producer at those sessions was Don Was. I don't know if you're familiar with Don Was, but I really, he's like a legendary producer too, and he was there. It's not the overwhelming thing, because actually before I did the Stones thing, Dave Hewitt and I worked on some records together with some people that I was actually really admired, but to meet those guys was just more surreal than anything else, and you know, we were just kind of there to like do our job and make sure that everything was cool.
Right.
So I you know, definitely thought it was awesome, but I didn't really have much space to think about that type of thing, if you know what I mean.
So you basically went about it as a professional, right?
Right. I mean, we prepared for it for, you know, we knew it was coming for quite a while. It was scheduled like well over a month in advance.
Wow.
And Dave and I...
Before that, what were your feelings about that? Holy shit, I'm going to record the Rolling Stones? Or?
Yeah, no, I thought it was definitely a holy shit moment. And it was like, you know, it was like the week of my like 28th birthday. Like I had my birthday one of those nights. So it was like a really awesome experience, like all around. So yeah, it was definitely like a holy shit thing.
When you talk to like Keith Richards or Mick Jagger,
I didn't talk to Mick Jagger at all.
At all.
Mick Jagger talked to me through the microphone when he was telling me when to hit record.
Wow.
But I didn't talk to him at all. I actually like really maintained my distance from all that stuff.
But that's the way to do it, though. That's the way I feel. I've at this point I've met a couple comedians that are not, you know, like they're not even in my realm, but. Like, the point is just to keep the distance.
Yeah.
But, like, did you feel like at a point, like, in your, when you were recording, like, holy shit, like, I'm doing this, like.
Yeah, I had a lot of time to think about it because it went on for 8 days.
Oh, so, absolutely.
And I'm not being sarcastic. Like, after, like, 4 days when everything was still going really well and we had no technical problems, I was basically going into work like flying on a friggin' like cloud of
Like, did you wake up like holy shit? Yeah, today I'm going to record the Rolling Stones.
I just woke up floating out of my bed, feeling like $1 million, and I couldn't even tell like any of my like best buddies about it. I think I told Dan about it, and my girlfriend obviously, but I couldn't tell anybody about it. And I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. You know,
we're not violating your non-disclosure agreement right now, are we?
No, not at all. But yeah, it was it was definitely a cool thing to do, and we were all like really proud of it at the workplace, you know. And we.
How is Keith Richards?
He's super nice, and
he's got to be the nicest guy in the world. He looks like he is.
You know, my encounter, which, like I said. It wasn't insane. It was like brief, you know. It was just like, all right, this is happening, and then, you know, like seeing these people around for a week. But he looks great in person. I don't know why why people think that he looks so bad in pictures and everything. He looked really smooth and like he had just been like relaxing for a long time.
Did he say anything to you that you thought would be, you know, anything that would like help you out as a musician?
No,
that's even better.
Did these guys know that you were even a musician? Did that come out of the conversation?
No, definitely not.
Yeah. All right, so now you recorded the Rolling Stones. You got to feel like you accomplished something, and Bill, you should feel like you accomplished something. you recorded one of the top, literally, I can't think of three live bands that are bigger than them.
Like I said, dude, it was an experience that most people in my like area wouldn't get to do, but I did get to do it, and it was great, man. And you know what? It was a miracle that I got to do it. But I feel like we did it really well, and I feel like the recordings came out really good, and so that's actually what really
Where could we hear those recordings now?
Well, unless they release the video footage that they took, which I'm assuming someday they will.
Like a DVD or something?
Yeah, then you probably wouldn't hear the rehearsal recordings, because what I had to do was I had to put them on an external hard drive and give it to someone every day, and then I had to delete it off my computer. Like, I couldn't keep any of that stuff.
Right.
So it exists somewhere in Holland, which is apparently where they keep all of their archival recordings. But it doesn't exist with me, and I didn't.
Well, at least we know in Holland that some potheads are going to be like, "I'll put it online."
I mean, hopefully. I mean, depends on how lax their security is, but you know, that's amazing.
When I saw that, I was so proud of you, man. Like,
I appreciate that.
Now, like a couple months later. That brings me to the second thing. You recorded Black Sabbath.
I did not record Black Sabbath.
You did not?
No, we had Black Sabbath in the studio.
Oh.
But we did not do any recording.
But you had Sabbath in the studio.
We did. We did the pre-production with Black Sabbath for their 13 tour, which they're still kind of on.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. And you know, that's what we do a lot of times, because the mixing and front of house consoles that they're using are usually digital now, so they're able to record really easily off that. So that's usually what their recording element is when they're coming in. They bring all their own equipment, if you know what I'm saying.
Wow. But yeah. You met Black Sabbath then.
I did.
How?
Except for Ozzy. I didn't actually get to meet Ozzy because he only came in for 2 days. Mm-hmm. I was there the days
Did you meet Tony Iommi?
Yeah, we all got to meet and see the whole band. But they were really only rehearsing, like the band for Black Sabbath. The band themselves only rehearsed like probably 3 or 4 hours a day. And the crew was there for like 9 hours a day.
Was the drummer from Rage Against the Machine there?
No, it was Tommy Clefados, who he's a great drummer. He played drums in White Zombie actually for a while.
Okay.
He was the drummer. And actually, he was there.
Wasn't the guy from Rage the drummer on the album?
He was, but he's not touring with that band.
Oh, all right.
But yeah, that's what we did for Sabbath, and you know, it was really good. And we set up their sound guys in our control room, where we have our console and all of our stuff. But they had their own kind of smaller digital consoles that they use, and we set them up kind of, you know, in a little mobile area for that, because that's what they wanted to use.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's so great for you, man, and you deserve it. You really do.
Oh, thanks, dude. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You know, we did do some recording. We did some recording with Edward Sharp.
Really?
Yeah, which was really cool. I mean, they came in and we set up a. It was before I actually got our control room put back together. So we. I made this recording setup in our garage where we load trucks and stuff, and I had like a bunch of really nice API preamps and EQs and like, a bunch of Grace Millennia preamps, which is a
right.
You know, very decent preamp, and we set them up like a little control room back there, and they used our live room to do a bunch of tracking for their next record, which was you know, it was cool. They all like sat in a circle. Did a weird fucking hippie shit. But yeah, we did that, and you know, there's a bunch of other stuff. You know,
I heard you. Lately, you've also been having Jay-Z in the studio.
We did.
How's he?
I don't know. I didn't meet him.
You didn't meet him?
No, I mean, that was another one. I mean, this is the way that kind of rehearsals go sometimes. You know, basically, like, we had, we hosted the Jay-Z Beyonce On the Run tour. That's the tour that they're currently on.
Do the Roots play with him or no?
No, actually, the drummer.
Not anymore?
The drummer for Jay-Z was Tony Royster Jr. He's a fantastic drummer.
I'm sure he is.
But anyway, no, we hosted their tour production. So basically, they rehearse for their tour. They kind of figure out what all the musical parts are, and then they'll usually go, like, after us, they'll go and rent, like, the Izod Center or the Timex Arena or something, and they'll practice their show there for a few days, and then they go on tour. So that's what we did for them, and it was a pretty long week, and it's mostly like the sound guys and the techs that need that rather than the artists, because
right. The
artists, they really, you know, they know how to play, they know their songs already.
All right, Bill.
Yeah.
I don't want to bog people down with bog you down with like celebrity shit, but so I have a couple bits to do with you.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah. Three albums right now that people should be listening to. Go ahead. Three albums that you think that a music person should listen to.
Three albums.
What have you been into lately?
Let me think. Jesus.
I don't want to put you in the spot, but I am.
I like.
Have you been, what's Bill listening to on the way to work?
Shit.
All right, let me trim that down. One album someone should listen to.
Jeez. I mean, just give me 2 seconds to think. I can definitely come up with three.
Bill, this is shitty, man. You're my music guy. You gotta give me an album, bro.
Shit. You know what I really like? I really love the Life Aquatic soundtrack, the Sue George version of the Life Aquatic soundtrack, which is all Portuguese versions of David Bowie songs sung on the nylon string guitar.
Really?
Yeah.
Adam, an album you've been listening to?
Well, I don't know the name of the album, but one group I guess I've been listening to a lot lately is the Chris Robinson Brotherhood.
Okay.
Chris Robinson being the lead singer from the Black Crowes.
Oh, yeah.
People know him. Black Crowes over the years have split apart and gone back together, and they have probably 1,000 side projects between Chris and Rich Robinson and the other guys in the group. And they all do some pretty awesome stuff. But most recently, I've definitely been listening to. He's got either 2 or 3 albums out in the past, maybe 2 years since the last Black Crowes tour under the Chris Robinson Brotherhood label. He's done a lot of different side projects, but that's the most recent one. And they just have a really folksy kind of vibe to it. You know, you still get a little bit of the Black Crowes, a little bit of rock, a little bit of funk, a little bit of, you know, but a lot of real folksy bluegrass kind of vibe to it. Some real cool, just laid back kind of tunes. Real just good, happy cruising music. Good stuff to listen to in the car.
That sounds good. Bill, any comment on that?
I totally agree.
And I'm going to throw a freaking loophole in this interview, and I'm very much looking forward to the new Busta Rhymes album, which, by the way, he says that it's all going to be samples and beats, and he's calling it Extinction Level Event 2. And if you have heard the Eminem and Busta Rhymes song where they sample House of Pain, you got to give it a listen. It's fucking amazing. Busta you know, he went through all his goddamn shit. But fucking, if you ever listen to fucking Tribe Called Quest shit with Busta Rhymes, it sounds like it's going back to that. Bill, you don't like Busta Rhymes?
No, I have to. I have to know.
You don't like Busta Rhymes?
Do I like Busta Rhymes?
Old Busta Rhymes.
Old Busta Rhymes? I mean, he had something going on. We all know that. I mean, that's easy to see. But, I mean, you know, am I going to get introspective and sit on my fucking couch with a set of headphones on and listen?
Oh, probably not.
Hell no, dude.
But if you were having a party and you were having a couple of Coronas.
I just don't do that.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever. All right. That brings me. So we got Busta Rhymes. We got Adam over here. Chris Robinson Brothers. And Bill, what was yours?
I mean, you know,
What was yours? You just said it 2 minutes ago.
Oh, what did I say 2 minutes ago? I was talking about the Sue George record of
Sue George
covers in Portuguese. But I mean, I love the new Queens of the Stone Age record, the like Clockwork, like Block, whatever it's called. And I love. What's the other? I like Tame Impala a lot. I don't know if you dig that.
It's Word Association in this bitch.
Okay, you have to give me three words that you would associate, and the theme today is New Jersey. Okay?
Yeah.
So, three words for what I'm going to throw out to you, okay? Mm-hmm. The first word is New Jersey music. Three words, go. Go ahead. Three words.
Good.
Corny.
Good.
Corny.
Good, unless it's on Facebook.
Okay. And?
You know, I don't know. Cover band.
Cover band. Okay. The next topic is sticking with the theme of New Jersey. What is three words you associate with New Jersey? Downtime is the word. Downtime, when you have nothing to do.
Sitting around eating outside a bistro wannabe place in Hoboken.
All right, you just threw a lot of words. The word you could have threw was outside.
Okay.
Okay, what's the second word?
Downtime, I don't know. New Jersey. Walking around.
Walking. Okay. Third word, Bill. Third word. Downtime. You're on your downtime. What do you think about?
Taylor Ham sandwiches.
There it is. Taylor Ham. Perfect. And the fact that you called it Taylor Ham makes me mad because it's pork.
Oh, I know it's pork. Please.
All right.
I know you're trying to for a wider audience. That's why I'm.
Next topic is three words associated with driving in New Jersey.
Parking ticket.
Parking ticket. I'll take that as one word.
Idiot.
Idiot. That's two.
Stupid.
Stupid. Absolutely. Aggressive would be a good one.
Aggressive is a good one too, yeah.
All right. Three words for New Jersey dating.
Whore.
Dating. Dating.
Yeah, whore is the first one.
Whore is number one.
Eyeshadow.
Eyeshadow two.
Pizza place.
Pizza place? It's three? Pizza place? Bill.
Yeah, that's a word.
All right, perfect. I got two more for you. I don't mean to put you in the spot, but this is what we do here. All right. The next one is New Jersey food. Three words.
Pork roll.
Yes. Yeah. Perfect.
Grilled cheese sandwiches.
That counts as one word.
French fries.
And the last word I have for you is New Jersey love. What do you love about New Jersey? Three words.
Three words.
Folks, he loves nothing about New Jersey.
No, I love a lot of things about New Jersey. The accessibility.
Great.
Accessibility is one. Seasonal change.
Yes.
That's it. No, it's only two things.
All right. So he loves two things about New Jersey. And, Bill, you have anything to plug?
No, man. I mean, you know, I don't have anything to plug.
What's the name of your studio?
It's called Iwi.
What's the website?
iwisound.com. It's iwiisound.com.
Okay. So go hit that up. Thank you, Bill, for being on the podcast.
Sure.
Fucking awesome ass interview. Keep the wind at your back, and I love you.